If psychology and pop culture had a baby, they'd call it the Shrink Tank Podcast. Our illustrious panel of shrinks analyze and psychoanalyze what's happening in entertainment and pop culture. I'm Dave Verhagen. I'm a psychologist, an author, and of course, a bad magician. Across from me, Rachel Kitson. She's a psychologist and our media darling. She's written the most popular articles ever of all time, as Kanye would say, of all time, on shrinktank.com. Rachel, how do you feel knowing that you're the most popular author on shrinktank.com?
It feels great, I have to say.
Good. And Frank Gaskell is a psychologist. He's also the author of the Max Gamer graphic novel. He's also our resident insane person. And Frank is typically either upset or happy to an extreme. And Frank, are you worked up about something today?
Actually, I've been doing biofeedback lately.
Oh.
And I feel very peaceful, mindful, in the moment, and I'm experiencing tranquility today.
How's that going for you?
Pretty good.
Yeah, I'm liking that.
Thank you.
Yeah, good. Good to have you here, Frank. And Jonathan Hederle is a counselor, a critic, and our sarcasm all-star. And Jonathan's been following some stories of psychology in the news. We call it being human. Jonathan, what have you been following this week?
Well, an article recently made headlines on HuffingtonPost.com titled "White Men Have Less Life Stress, But Are More Prone to Depression Because of It." And the basic premise is that white men report having fewer stressful events than black men, such as poor health, financial stress, employment, or family problems, but they're more likely to face depression associated with stressful life events more so than black men or women of any race.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. It's basically saying that because white men haven't had to deal with much stress in their lives, they're not very well equipped to handle it. So when they face it later on in life, they don't have that post-traumatic kind of growth experience that other races and genders might have had to go through. And
this is stressing me out.
You're just, you're out of luck, white guys. What do you guys have to say about this?
I need my biofeedback machine. I am so stressed right now.
This is stressing me out to no degree. No end, I mean. I totally 100% agree with this.
Mm-hmm.
100%.
This is the first research study I've ever read that I agree with.
It's a nicer way of saying white privilege, right?
It is.
It actually is. But no, I do agree with it. I mean, I think just from my experience in life and experience in therapy with clients is that when people don't have things that really test them, things that really challenge them, things that are difficult when they're younger and growing up, that a lot of times when they run into the usual wear and tear and stressors of life, they get more depressed. And a lot of times they're really confused by that. I mean, I have guys in my office on a regular basis saying, I've got a good family, I go to a good school, I have a girlfriend, I'm doing well, and I have no reason to be depressed. Now, sometimes that's because they're prone to be depressed biologically, but sometimes it's just because they're facing applying to colleges or college stress or things like normal things, and it's just wearing them out.
That's why I am a fairly stress-free individual.
Right.
Because I was raised in Iran, right. And I was bullied on a daily basis. And so now I'm a happy, resilient man. Stress-free individual, and I identify with the plight of those who
minorities.
Have had... Yes, I do. Thank you. Thank you very much for that, Rachel.
I think actually Frank is...
the definition of resilience.
Frank is always the exception to every study.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's the outlier. He's the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah. I got a phone call at 2 in the morning. The American NBC said, women and children out of the country. I didn't see my dad for 7 months. I was literally beaten up every week at school. I had no friends for 4 years straight. And I'm happy as a clam.
Yeah. Yeah. All that's true except the happy as a clam part.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, see, this research study's crap.
Well, I think the thing that's going to be interesting for me to see is with the helicopter parent generation, are we going to even see a greater influx of this?
Because
absolutely. Parents have even some of the normal challenges and setbacks that previous generations have experienced early on in life, they've been shielding and protecting them from it. And so now are we going to see... You know, Dave, you and I focus a lot on this idea of a quarter-life crisis where even younger age, they're getting set back in life and they're getting stuck and not know how to cope and handle it.
I think it's absolutely true. I think we're going to see more of it, to be real honest. That's been my experience just clinically is that you've got these guys that are really nice guys, and they, you know, they're kind of despairing about things in their life because they haven't really had challenges. They've been soft growing up.
All right. So our next article comes from elitedaily.com, and it's headline, "Science says going to a concert can be just as effective as medicine." So according to one study conducted by the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center that compared the effects of live music versus recorded music, data shows that live music promoted vigor and relieved more stress and tension in cancer patients than that of recorded music, the key component being the human element that's inherent in live music.
I actually agree, even though I don't go to concerts.
Well, you don't like concerts.
Right. But I don't like humans, so therefore, the conclusion is, if I'm around the humans, which are at concerts, I'm upset. Mm-hmm. But if I listen to my recorded playlist, it's my medicine. So there's that. Another study that's wrong.
Or right, and you're the outlier.
Yeah. Rachel, any thoughts about the impact of something like a concert on someone's well-being?
Mental health. Yeah, I mean, I think these sort of studies, I think are a little obvious in some ways. I mean, doing things that where you have human connection, or we know the benefits of music and creativity. We know that music has kind of healing properties to it for people. So going to see it live, I mean, that it all sort of makes sense to me.
Jonathan, you and I are big concert goers. I've been to over 150 concerts. You've been to a ton of concerts. Do you have a sense of this idea of this being therapeutic?
I've never thought of it necessarily in those terms, but it makes complete sense to me. The human connection, the power, the transcendent power of music. And I love live music more than even my recorded catalog. There's just something about having a connection with the band or the artist right then and there. And it feels very personal, even in a stadium of 5 or 10,000, that we're having a connection right there. And to me, it's a very powerful experience.
Yeah. And the other fans too, there's communion. You know, I don't go to church super regularly, but one of my favorite parts of church or sort of religious service is the music part of it. And so I think having that connection with people around you and the shared enjoyment and shared experience is really powerful. I think there are people such as Frank who find concerts kind of traumatic and overstimulating.
Or life.
So I think, I'm sure there are, for some people, they could have an opposite effect as well.
One of the last concerts I saw, actually Jonathan and I saw it together, was Sufjan Stevens in Durham. And I'll tell you, as I reflect on it, it was a therapeutic experience. I mean, it's not only are you watching this guy sing about these very, very intimate parts of his life, but it's also connecting with the audience. And you're feeling this thing happening with the whole audience where they're having these emotional moments of experiencing not only what he's gone through, but reflecting on their own lives and reflecting on themselves.
She goes cuddle
a little bit.
Yeah. Awesome.
It was nice.
No, I think that's a cool point though. Everyone brings their kind of own experience of the music to the concert too, which is pretty cool.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about our trending topic. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. This is Dave Verhagen along with Jonathan Hederle, Rachel Kitson, and Frank the Psych Weasel. And our trending topic today is Netflix and the Beast of No Nation in particular. And this is why it's trending. Netflix, of course, is not necessarily a trending topic because it's just already eaten up the pop culture landscape. But Beast of No Nation is going to be released this week, and it is going to be a landmark film, and I'll tell you why.
Tell us, Dave.
I will. Well, thank you, Frank. This film is going to be released concurrently on Netflix and in theaters. What that does is it makes it eligible for Oscar consideration. So this is the first film that is really made for streaming, but that is going to get Oscar buzz. So that's huge because it really is revolutionizing the model of delivery for how films are, I'm talking prestige films, are introduced to the culture. Mm-hmm. The rules of the Academy are that it has to screen in a theater during the calendar year. So they're doing that really, they're releasing it in the theater just so they can meet the conditions of the Academy. But really the film is a streaming film. So you're going to have this buzz about this movie that's really a Netflix film. And that's all the early word on it says that it is going to get probably a Best Picture nomination, Best Actor, screenplay, and so on, maybe director. So this is pretty big. This is huge.
This is proving what I predicted, just me, I think, years ago, that theaters are going to get smaller and smaller and smaller to the point that there are going to be movies on YouTube and people doing these website movies where the whole industry is going to completely change. We're going to be seeing movies more and more differently as the technology allows so many people to make their own films.
I would think this is going to freak a lot of people out.
I would hope so.
Especially since a movie that could get Oscar consideration and in the award season that people don't have to pay to see. Like, I think the last major step was when they started to release stuff in theaters and video on demand, you know, at the same time. But still, video on demand, you would have to pay money for that. If you have a subscription to Netflix, you're going to be able to watch this movie here absolutely free. Something that otherwise people are, usually they release it so they can maximize the money that they make. Like, that's really the prestige of the Oscars, is it raises the revenue that you generate.
But you got to pay for Netflix.
Well, I think people have found a way around that as well.
Oh, really?
Well, but not just, you're paying, his point also is $8
is a
standard fee, and you're getting whatever's on there.
Like, the thing that's all about Netflix is being able to show my kids these movies that I can't find anywhere that are just like all the Godzilla films, that even if there was still a blockbuster or something like that, I wouldn't be able to find them.
Do you think that it will be fascinating if this is as good a movie as it sounds like it is, mm-hmm. and it gets overlooked? I mean, that will be really telling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's going to be, there's going to be a lot of debate about that, because you know the Academy is weighing all these things about how does this affect our theater owners, our exhibitors, all that kind of stuff. We know that that's going to be a consideration. I think it's going to do something disruptive to this whole industry.
Yeah, who do you think is going to pay money to go see it if it is going to be free on Netflix as well?
Well, that's a good question. And actually, let's open that up broader and say, is this a movie that you would see? And is there still a draw for a film that you could see streaming that you would go to see in on the big screen in a large theater?
I would not see it in the theater. There's not a chance.
Oh, I would. Totally. The people that are involved, like, this is right up my alley.
But see, I'm at the point with film when I take my wife, two kids, they always get Mike and Ike, Sweet Tarts, popcorn. I mean, it costs a fortune. And so I reserve that for The Martian, Jurassic World, these blockbusters that I have to visually see in a theater. The rest of it, I'm just not going to do it.
Okay, so take that idea and let's say the next Jurassic World film.
Absolutely, in the theater.
Produced by Netflix.
Yeah.
Or something like that. That idea. And it's like, okay, you can watch it on Netflix tonight, or you can go this weekend and watch it at the movie theater. You're going to the movie theater.
Yeah, no question. There's a certain genre of film that will always be in the theaters. A Star Wars movie would never be just released on people's computers. There's always going to be room for that.
Well, one of the things that Beasts of No Nation will have an advantage for is when it comes to award season, a lot of times they have to send out screeners. And that was one of the things that Selma recently had problems with when it kind of started to get overlooked with the Academy, was they had a horrible strategy, marketing strategy, to get the screeners in the hands of as many voters. Beasts of No Nation, any Academy voter has complete access to it right away come October 16th.
Yeah, it's going to be very, very disruptive to this industry, and it's going to be very fascinating what happens with it. I think we're talking about something that is going to be in film history looked at as kind of a potential turning point. I think if it gets overlooked, even with that being the case, that's going to be a point of conversation too. Are they just now going to box out the really good films that aren't delivered the way that they want them to be delivered?
Or are they going to change the rules?
Are they going to change the rules?
Going back to the Star Wars analogy, since we're talking about Star Wars, Star Wars Episode 7, December 17th, 7:15 p.m., if that film over those 3 days or so doesn't make $600 million, I will be absolutely shocked. It's going to be a game changer. But the problem is that movie, Jurassic World, Marvel movies, those things are crowding out all these other films. But Netflix, Hulu, these other platforms offer us opportunity to see the movies that Hollywood's not going to make. So I think that's exciting.
Okay, so to keep pushing this a little bit further, you said a Star Wars or an Avengers or something like that is never going to be just seen on somebody's computer.
Right.
When you say never, do you mean never? Like in the year 2040, are we going to have movie theaters?
Yes.
Because of the communal experience?
Yes.
The same reason why we have concerts still?
Yes, same way we have concerts, but the venues may look real different, where you have much more massive, almost, what's that, LA theater? I can't think.
Like stadiums.
Yes, stadium seating.
Well, that's
much more massive in scale. And that it will be more of an event that a ton of people go, they watch it for a week or so, and then you see it maybe in your home on your 14 by 24 virtual screen or something.
Yeah, and
like
it's already kind of going in that direction with IMAX and the 3D things, making it more of a production.
Yeah, I think it'll have to get bigger because home entertainment systems are getting bigger and they're getting relatively less expensive. So as you have that, the quality of watching it at home increases. The only thing they can do is either lower the cost, which they're not going to do, or they have to increase the size and the spectacle.
I think also thinking about kind of the younger generation too, and what they're used to seeing. I mean, they're not used to watching movies in a theater setting. I mean, they're perfectly content to watch it on their phone or their watch or their computer or their, you know, whatever, their device. So I think that could change sort of the nature too of the movement.
Yeah, and it is interesting to use that parallel, is that, you know, there are people that pirate their music, that, you know, they get their music kind of either free or cheap, and yet concerts still exist and they thrive. Mm-hmm. And there's still a segment of people that are going to want to go to see live events and big communal events. And so I do wonder if there's still going to be 20 years from now, 25 years from now, even though the technology can deliver it to someone's watch or phone or whatever, that or virtually in kind of like a Oculus sort of delivery, if there's going to be a place in the culture for these kind of big communal events.
Always there's
but we've
if you get 1,000 people packed into a theater and you're going to show Star Wars an opening night, I'd pay $250 for that ticket, and I bet you'd get 1,000 people who would.
But I also think the communal experience is changing for younger generations, too. They don't all need to be in the same place to have that shared sense of community. Right. In fact, I think more and more relationships are in separate places at larger distances. So I think that the idea of communion is going to be changing as well. And a lot of my clients who really like music, you know, they're listening to their music streaming on, you know, these algorithms that are choosing their music for them on Spotify or, you know, whatever. And so they don't even know some of the artists that they're listening to, and they just like the music.
Yeah. I think this will always have a place because the film industry by its very design is dependent upon technology, and the advancements in technology and the monetary revenue and value behind it is just unprecedented. So there is an incentive to continue to push the envelope and create and be innovative, which is only going to make the film viewing experience that much more tremendous in years to come.
All right, we're going to extend this conversation by talking specifically about The Beast of No Nation and another project that goes along with that in our next segment. We're going to take a break. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. I'm Dave Verhagen, along with Jonathan Hederle, Rachel Kitson, and Frank Gaskell. And we're talking about Netflix and Beasts of No Nation. And we've been talking about how Beasts of No Nation might be a disruptive film because it is apparently a really, really good movie that might get Oscar buzz, and it's released on Netflix. And what is the industry going to do about that? And are we still going to have theaters? But what we're learning about Beast of No Nation is that it is a really powerful film set in West Africa about child soldiers and a warlord. And Idris Elba is apparently fantastic in this movie. Everybody that's seen it already has just raved about it. It looks like a fantastic film. Any of you got any other, either seen the trailers or gotten any advanced word on it?
Yeah, I've seen the trailers, and the word out of like the Toronto International Film Festival has said it's a very powerful film. Like, it's unprecedented for something like a watershed sort of event in pop culture to have the quality that it does.
Well, here's a cool thing that we've got here in our community is that we're actually publishing a book called Liberia's Son. And it is a real-life account of a guy who grew up in West Africa, in Liberia. His mom was very poor. She taught herself to read, to write. She worked herself up to getting a job. They had a nice house. And then the war, the civil war in Liberia, overran the country and really overtook the city before anyone even knew that it was coming. They were lined up. They were going to be gunned down. And they escaped. And then ended up going from place to place to get away from the war and became refugees in a refugee camp. And I won't give all of it away of how it ends, but it's a really, really cool story. It's about a guy named UJ Harris, and we're really excited about it. So in future podcasts, we're going to be talking about him and maybe interviewing him and also talking about this book some more. But it feels like it's a really cool angle that we've got that this movie and this book are really hitting the same kinds of themes.
Yeah, I hope the marketing and the awareness of the Beasts of No Nations really opens a conversation about a number of different stories about, you know, child soldiers and just some of the horrors but the resiliency and the survival stories that I know that are just out there.
I'll tell you, I had the sneak peek of reading the little teaser of this book, and I could not put it down. I mean, I was bummed that it ended where it did. I can't wait to read the entire thing.
Yeah, and it's a true story. It's one of these things that it's almost like you can't make it up. It goes from one crazy thing to another mm-hmm. crazy thing, and it's all real, and it's all very powerful. So we're looking forward to having that out and talking with you, Jay, and we're just putting that on your radar for just thinking about picking up that book. But when you're looking at this movie, The Beast of No Nation, and we want you to be thinking about Liberia's Son, because if you want to read a real life account of this mm-hmm. And what this was like, because this guy, UJ, literally was inches away from being conscripted as mm-hmm. a child soldier. The one of the soldiers came by and said, "You'll make a good soldier." And this is when he's a child. He's like 13 years old. He says, "You'll make a good soldier. I'm going to come back for you tomorrow." And his family and the people he was staying with, they literally hid him in different places until he could get away. Hmm. So it's pretty intense.
Where will we be able to buy this book?
Oh, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Hero House Publishing.
Will it be an ebook with interesting videos embedded in it?
Well, yes, it will, Frank. Thanks for asking.
That's exciting.
I know. Thank you for asking all those very, very good questions.
Absolutely, David.
Nice. All right, we're going to wrap up our podcast with what we call our doctor's orders. These are things that we're personally enjoying in pop culture. And Jonathan, do you have anything for us?
A couple things. On Amazon Prime, if you have that available, there's a new show called Red Oaks that is now available. They tested the pilot out about a year ago. I caught it. It's a great coming-of-age comedy set in the 80s. And then also check out shrinktank.com, and you'll read my review of Josh Ritter's latest album, Sermon on the Rocks.
Rachel?
I've been going through Pace's list of, talking about Netflix, their list of 100 top films on Netflix, and we've been watching going through that list, and we just saw the movie called The Station Agent. Oh, yeah. And it's a feel good movie.
Peter Dinklage.
Yes, yeah. Very. It's really good. I recommend it.
I would too.
Have you seen Star Wars yet? I hear it's on that list.
Frank would like to recommend Star Wars.
I would like to recommend Star Wars on December 17th at 7:15, and I'd also like to publicly announce that Southeast Psych bought 274 tickets, and the entire practice, colleagues, staff, and families will be there in attendance, and can I say, quote, no line for me.
Oh, snap. Mm. Yep, we're going opening night. It's guaranteed. It's going to be super fun. And I'm going to recommend something that I don't think really needs a recommendation because you're either going to watch it or not, but we're watching Survivor again, and it's an especially good season. It's a good start. What they've done
is
they've brought back people that have been on the show before, but not won. So it's a second chance. They've done this before where they've had all-stars, and it includes people that have won or people that have come in, you know, second or whatever. This is just, like, this could have been somebody that, you know, got, they for whatever reason, the ball took a funny hop, and they just, it didn't work out well for them, but they were a very good player. They brought these people back. It's a good season, so I'd recommend anybody that might be interested jumping on this season of Survivor.
I am loving it.
All right. That's going to do it for this edition of the Shrink Tank Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Shrink Tank Talk, or you can like us on Facebook by searching for Shrink Tank. And of course, you can check us all out on shrinktank.com, where you'll find articles about all kinds of cool things in popular culture related to pop culture and psychology. Our engineer and audio wizard is Zach Brown. For Rachel Kitson, Jonathan Hederle, and Frank Gaskell, I'm Dave Verhagen. Have a great week.